Good evening, friends, and welcome. We've been going through a great deal of evolution in our thinking about the universe, about our own world, and about our own personal lives during the last few centuries, and perhaps that whole process could be spoken of as having speeded up enormously in the present century. Much of the trouble that we face comes from not really knowing how to look at the world anymore, not being able to see it and understand it clearly in the light of our old traditions, and yet not knowing how to come upon it in a new way that will embrace and help us to relate to the present insights, the present understanding that we face of the universe. One example is that a few centuries ago, we used to believe that the world was quite comfortably the center of the whole universe, that the universe itself was very small. People didn't really know what those stars were out there, but there were various fanciful ideas. For example, that there was a great curtain up there, and the stars were little pinholes in that curtain. The concept of the world and its age was very different from what we know it to be today. They thought that the world, in fact, my Bible, which was printed in, I think, 1924, the present edition, not obviously the King James Version came out much earlier, but the annotations, the notes, and so on. In this Bible, it is stated something to the effect that the world was created, I think, on September 9th in the year 4003 BC at 9 a.m. Well, we can laugh at that kind of idea now. It's very hard for anybody to cling to the concept that the world was really created so recently, because everything that we know, I have heard a few diehards claim that when you point out that all these layers in the world and all the discoveries of the erosion of the mountains and the pushing up of the continents and so on, that all of these were created by Satan to cause us to doubt the Bible. But I think it takes a pretty remarkable degree of stupidity. You might almost speak of that kind of stupidity on the level of a genius of its own kind, that anybody can really believe it. We have found that, on the contrary, the world is very, very old, and the universe, which seemed to be, first we thought that the universe was centered in the earth, then we thought, well, it must be centered in the sun. Now we don't find any center anywhere. We don't really know in a cosmic sense whether we're coming or going, because we can't tell whether anything we're moving toward is really moving toward us, or whether maybe it's going in the same direction but we're going a little bit faster than it is. There's just no way of knowing. And so we find in our own personal lives also that there is a sense of disorientation. I've written a book on the subject. I took about 10 years studying it. It's called Crises in Modern Thought, and it deals with this idea of the relativity of values and the seeming meaninglessness of the universe and of life. And I've brought my years of training in the Vedanta philosophy to bear on the discoveries of science, and I've found to a lot of people's satisfaction, people who are scientists themselves, that in fact the findings of science don't at all undermine the meaning of life, don't at all undermine the sense of direction and purpose in life. What they really do is simply broaden our horizons and necessitate a new interpretation of life, but not an unreligious one, not an unspiritual one, not one that takes away all sense of purpose. Nowadays, people, because they have been stripped of this sense of purpose, not knowing where they're going or why, the common dogma today is that really there is no purpose to it at all, that we're born here just sort of by accident, that we live here with no real purpose except any kind of personal purpose that we can wrest from our own lives, that there is no God, that there is no direction in human life or in evolution, that man came here purely by accident, some sort of whimsy on the part of a mindless destiny that produced our human bodies, and there's no real purpose to it ultimately, except to get what you can for yourself right now. Dig into this world and get yours before you die. And so it is that as a result, people don't feel that there is any reason not to kill, not to steal, not to live selfishly, not to live only for their own ends. And unfortunately, we find that whatever cosmic rule there be up there, whatever cosmic purpose there be up there, whatever kind of reason there may be to this whole universal scheme of things, we are finding that we, as individuals, are most certainly going against a law of our own nature. There have been people in our century, Jean-Paul Sartre is perhaps the prime example, who say that we must absolutely create our own values, and if we choose to live selfishly, murderously, criminally, who is to say that this is not a saintly act as that of the greatest saint who ever lived, as long as we are true to our own purpose? But the trouble is that our purpose is something altogether different from our own nature. He thinks that we create our nature as we go along, sort of winging it the way Jerry Brown does. But it doesn't work quite that easily. Can you honestly say that you can go against the laws of your own body to the extent that that you can create the laws of your own body, to the extent that you can eat nothing but white sugar all the time, nothing but pastries? Can you do it and get away with it? You can do it, but you can't get away with it. Yes, you've got the freedom to try, but you find that sooner or later you lose your freedom because your body begins to break down under the burden of abuse. You can't eat nails. Your body's made in a certain way, and you have to learn what the laws of that body are. And some people say, in Sartre's prime example, that in that case we wouldn't be free. Well, the truth is that you're much less free when you're sick than when you're well. You're much less free when your mind is clogged and can't think clearly than you are when you learn to treat your body and mind as an entity that will work harmoniously within its own boundaries. And suddenly, for instance, fasting creates a much clearer mind than overeating. If you spend your whole time eating nothing but French pastries and overeating all the time, you'll find that pretty soon you become like those people who you ask them a question and they sort of sit there chewing the cud and, well, okay, maybe. They don't know. They're so dull-minded that they can't answer a simple question. They have no energy. They have no power to concentrate. What kind of freedom is it that makes them vegetate? Obviously, there is within the boundaries of our own lives a certain rule, a certain truth that we must discover. We must discover how to eat properly. We must discover how to exercise our bodies. We must discover how to concentrate our minds. We must discover that there is a certain flow of energy in our bodies, and if we go against that flow, we are going to interrupt, to go against our own nature, and as a result, to become bound. These truths exist on all levels of our reality, not to bother for the moment with the cosmic realities. We may not know, in fact, we cannot know about such cosmic questions as whether there's a God or not. I remember a man who was trying to convert me to his church, and I was trying to say there are many paths to truth, and I don't necessarily have to go according to your path. There may be other ways of defining God or reality or whatever. Well, he wasn't buying that because the Bible said so-and-so, you see, and he chose to interpret the Bible the way it wrote for him. And I finally said, you know, there's one thing that you and I must both accept, and that is that when we talk about these truths, these high ideas, when we talk about God, we're both wrong. How can we possibly know somebody who is, or some consciousness, or some reality that is so far beyond and above our own actual state of experience right now? We've got to start where we are. So let's leave aside questions of God and cosmic destiny. It may be that there is no kind of purpose there. I don't believe it for a minute, and I don't think many of you do. But I don't think it matters either, because the fact is that right here and right now there are certain realities that go far beyond our own body. There is a demand. There was a dogma in the early part of the century, and it's still held by a lot of people, that if you can give a person enough food to eat and a roof over his head, he'll have all that he wants. Well, we find here in this room people who look as if they had enough to eat, and they look as if they had a roof over their heads. Why are you here? You're here because there is a demand in the soul also for wisdom. There is a demand in human nature for something more than just this kind of vegetative existence. We want to know, we want to understand, we want to relate. And it goes along that line of reasoning to understand that anything that not only robs us of physical health, but that robs us of the capacity for love, that robs us of the capacity for joy, that diminishes our sense of awareness, diminishes our sense of identity with the world, of ability to relate to the world around around ourselves, these too offend against our own nature. Unless and until we can understand and accept that we are a triune being, not just body and mind, but body, mind, and soul. That we have a subconscious and a conscious and also a superconscious, that there is this level of reality that we're reaching up, we're trying to wake up. We're not really fully awake yet, and very few people are very awake at any time in their lives. Very few people have that kind of peak experience, as it's described, where they feel suddenly totally aware, even in the senses, even in their own bodies. They've taken candid cameras in supermarkets where, they've found that when people are in a state of hypnosis, the eyes become staring. Not calm, but staring. And they blink very little. And with that, they've examined people's eyes, eye movement, as they've gone through these aisles in the supermarkets and seen all these gaudy packages and start to take these packages off the shelves without any special reason for doing so. It's just so pretty. And you see their eyes getting more and more sort of hypnotized, literally, as they fill their carts up with all these lovely gimmicks and things. And then they get to the cash register, and as they see the bill rung up, suddenly they start blinking like mad as they come down to earth. People in this world are really in a state of partial hypnosis. They're partly asleep. It reminds me of a time many years ago when I dreamed that I was flying. And in my dream, I thought, well, this isn't the sort of thing people do. Maybe I'm dreaming. And I tried by the use of reason to determine whether I was asleep or awake. And whatever reasoning I could bring to bear, the trouble with reasoning is that it's always working within its own parameters and doesn't break out of them. So here I was working within the parameters that I had available to me in this sleep state, and I decided, according to the logic that was available to me at that time, according to the data that I had available, that I was awake and I was merely doing something unusual. Well, it was very surprising a moment later to wake up and find that I had been dreaming after all. We are in a state similar to that. In our normal waking state, we are not really awake. We're partly awake. I hope you all are at least partly awake here tonight. But in fact, most people go through life in a state of somnambulance. And that state of superconsciousness where we become totally aware, totally awake, so awake that we feel that we're a part of a much greater reality even than this ego, this is the state of consciousness that we are all reaching out toward and not quite touching. But when we get little glimmerings of it, then we begin to introduce into our lives a new dimension, a dimension that we call genius. That kind of inspiration that suddenly flows into life. And I've done this myself. I'm sure that many of you, if not all of you, have found periods in your lives when this worked, where your mind couldn't give you the answer, and you just put the mind aside. You turned the mind off, And you sort of looked up and thought, what shall I do? And suddenly that answer came. Well, when you know how to do it consciously, when you know that it doesn't come from the subconscious, it comes from a higher level of reality, and you lift your mind up into that consciousness, suddenly you find that you can work it very easily and all the time. Must learn that there are laws of our being, and that these laws demand that we become more harmonious, more integrated in our lives, more joyful, more loving, more aware. But the trouble is that we don't. And in our own lives, we recapitulate that same line of development that science has gone through in recent centuries, where from a false center of the universe, it suddenly concludes that there is no center in the universe, in our lives too. We get away from this center of ourself because, in a way, we're living in two worlds. One is that objective world that we see out there that science tells us is many, many hundreds of millions of light years across, maybe more than that. I don't know what the latest statistics are, but a universe that consists of hundreds of billions of galaxies, each one with hundreds of billions of stars, an incredibly vast universe. A universe that is fixed, that we can't very well change by any great effort on our part. We can't, with one vote, make very great impact in our government. We can't make any great impact in what the weather does, or what politics, or economics, or many things do in our lives. In one sense, this universe is something fixed, and we're a sort of a cog in a very great wheel. But in another way, we have our own universe, and each one of us creates his own universe. Each one of us is, in a sense, a cause, a creator of whatever he draws to himself, such that if we look upon the world with eyes of despair, we see cause for despair everywhere. If we look upon the world with eyes of joy, we see reason for joy everywhere. If we look upon the world with love, we find the world gives us love also. And that even those people who normally are hateful to others treat us lovingly. Or if they don't treat us lovingly, they, at any rate, somehow can't affect us. A little example that springs to my mind that I think you will very easily be able to duplicate many times over in your own lives, each one of you. Years ago, I was going to Europe, and I had to give lectures there, and as a result, I had all kinds of things for this lecture tour, including a harmonium and heaven knows what else. Well, as I was approaching the counter at Pan Am there in New York, I was getting a little bit worried because I thought, am I going to be able to carry these things on, or am I going to have to pay a huge amount of excess baggage? The man in front of me was the immediate cause of my worry because he had much less than I had, and the clerk behind the counter was insisting that he pay for every single ounce over the actual weight. And the man was getting more and more angry and upset and demanded to see the manager and was shouting that he'd never go on Pan Am again and so on. The more angry he got, the more determined this man was to milk him for every cent he could get. So I thought, well, I'll never win it if I go that route. So I came up and I just thought, well, God is in the form of this clerk here, and what does God want to do for me today? And I just came up with joyful expectation that everything would be fine. And the man looked at me and looked at my bags, and he said, okay, well, what do we got here today? Oh, right, and he just signed it in and passed it on through. Well, this is a fact that when we come to people trustingly, there was a story of Jim Corbett, who wrote Man-Eaters of Kumaon, and He said that his favorite hunting was done not with a gun, but with a camera. And he talked about being up on a machan in India, watching a tiger stalk a kid, goat. And this tiger was very stealthily coming, and the little goat heard a sound behind it and turned and saw this tiger. Well, it wasn't old enough to know that tigers were its natural enemy, and the simple trust of all young things, which makes them so lovable to all of us. It's so hard to think of hurting a baby because it trusts us. When people don't trust you, you think, you don't trust me, eh? And you, you are more likely, if you have it in you to hurt, to go ahead and hurt. Well, this goat looked around and saw this tiger and turned around and went up and sniffed it in the nose. Well, what could the poor tiger do? It just got up sort of huffily and turned around and stalked away. Well, when we come with a certain consciousness to the world, that's the kind of consciousness we are at least a great deal more likely to get back from the world. And the more we have of that consciousness, the more the world is likely to return that to us. What I'm saying is that in a way, two things are true. One is that we create our own world, that we see the world not only as it is, but also we color it according to, it's sort of like the sunlight coming through a stained glass window. If the light, if the pane of glass is blue, then the sun will look blue. If it's yellow, the sun will look yellow. The same light, but it will look different according to whatever filter it's coming through. So we will see the world according to the kind of consciousness we have. And it will look different to us. It will look meaningless if our lives are meaningless. If our lives are meaningful, it will be impossible to think of the universe as meaningless. But there's something else, too, that's perhaps as important or more so. And that is to realize that as far as we individually are concerned, we are the center of the universe. Because everything that we can ever understand, everything that we can ever control, everything that we can ever do in this world radiates outward from ourselves first. It's only from this center outward that we can reach out to the farthest galaxy. We are the center of the universe. And this is one of the greatest insights of the Indian scriptures, the Indian cultural traditions, philosophy. That is that God, divine consciousness, is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. It's a wonderful thing to meditate upon. I would urge you to take it into your meditations at home and think about it. Center everywhere, circumference nowhere. Because what this means in terms of our own lives is not only that we are centered here in reality, but that as we get out of that center, eccentric, as we start projecting outward because we think that reality is there and not here, two things happen. First of all, whatever light radiates outward from this center becomes diluted, just as an electric light bulb radiating light outward into the darkness. The farther you get away from that source, the weaker the light becomes. So if we think that our center is out there, in that home that we've built, in that job that we have, in these people that we're hoping to make our friends, in these problems that we're hoping to solve, if we think that our center is there and not here, first of all, we dilute that power that radiates outward from ourselves. Secondly, wherever we center our consciousness becomes a new center of power, a weaker center as far as our own source is concerned, but nonetheless, a center that creates its own magnetic power. Every center has a magnetic field. It's a vortex of energy, and it draws to itself whatever power it can. It's sort of like an electric current going through a wire sets up a magnetic field. So any source of energy, any source of power, anything to which we give power creates a magnetic field of its own, drawing to itself its own kind. Now, to bring this to a more practical level, the more we are centered at the source of our being, the more we are at the source of whatever power we ourselves can generate. The farther we get away from that source, the more we dilute that power. Love is the reality. Love is the reality of the universe. Love is the power of God. Love is our deepest nature. But the farther we get away from that love, there are no absolute opposites to light and love and joy and these divine qualities. There are only dilutions of those qualities to the point where that which was love at its source begins to seem like hatred far, far out on the periphery. The farther you get away from that inner light, the weaker and weaker it becomes, where there are no absolutes in the world of relativity. The absolutes only exist in the deep center of our existence, of our being. So what seems like hatred is only a diminution of love. To show you how values we hear nowadays that all truths are relative. Well, they are relative, but as I pointed out in that book of mine, Crises in Modern Thought, they're relative in a directional sense. To give you an example, if Mahatma Gandhi had, at the height of his career, said, well, I'm sick of serving humanity, I want to go out and make a fast buck and become a millionaire, everybody in the world, I think, would have said that he'd fallen from some kind of ideal. But if a very lazy person were to finally get off his bed of rest and decide he was going to go out and make a fast buck and become a millionaire, everybody would say, this is great, this is wonderful. The same thing, but from two different points of view, it's coming up for the person who's lazy, coming down for the person who's dedicated all his energy to a higher and broader ideal than merely self-service. In this way, values are relative. They're relative to one another. And so it is that suffering, once you've gotten used to it, in my book, The Path, I've mentioned a dream that I had when I was a boy in college, where I dreamed that I was that I'd been born in a torture chamber, and that everybody around me had been born in this same torture chamber. Our parents had been born in that torture chamber. Their parents had been born in this torture chamber. As far as we knew, there was no other existence but to be tortured. We had never heard of any other kind of life. Therefore, to us, happiness was when we were somewhat less tortured than usual. And we felt rather happy when the torturers didn't bother us so much. It was still torture, but it was joy to us. And it was a very interesting dream. It was a superconscious dream. I and a few other friends of mine began to discriminate after a while and to say, well, surely there's more to life than being tortured. And finally, one day, we rose up and we slew the torturers and we escaped. And we found that the torture chamber, which we had thought was the whole world, was really only the top floor of an otherwise empty building. We came out of that building onto a plane and we found that this plane extended miles and miles out to the horizon with no obstructions. And we found that this world was something vast. And we were breathing this freedom when I looked up. We looked up and we saw the torturers whom we had imagined that we'd killed wandering around torturing other people as if nothing had ever happened to them. We were so astonished at first. And then I looked at somebody and I said, don't you see, it's ourselves we've overcome, not the delusion, not the torturers. Then I woke up and I realized I'd had a very important dream for my own growth. Because what we've got to do is change our own understanding, not change the world. That's a very hopeful teaching, too, because you can't change the world, or you can change your understanding. If you can change yourself, the whole world, at least as far as you are concerned, will be a completely different place. This world can be a paradise. Even the sufferings of people, even though you feel for their suffering, you see the joy that you can give to them, and there's all this wonderful opportunity to help people, and no longer then is there a cause for bitterness, but only compassion. Well, then, all sorrow, all suffering, all pain, all hatred, all nervousness, these things are not realities in themselves. They are only a dilution of this power of love and joy and wisdom and so on, calmness, by having radiated so far outward from our own source that they no longer are true to this belief, this promise that we feel instinctively in our souls. But what happens is that the farther we get away from this source and become centered, it's sort of like standing in a dark field with a searchlight behind you, shining onto signs and objects in the opposite direction. Your back is to the light, to the source of light, but you see the reflection on those things. And you think that those things are light. You think they are giving you light. Think of a reflector on the back of a car, for example, or a bicycle. The world, the objects of the world reflect back to you. They are in themselves inanimate. There is no actual joy in things. Happiness, foremost, notwithstanding, is not a half gallon of ice cream. Happiness is in yourself, and until you can learn to find it there, it's like a story of George Bernard Shaw. He was sitting at a party, on the outskirts of the party, and the hostess came over and said, aren't you enjoying yourself? He looked up, he said, that's all I am enjoying. Whether with wisdom or not, I don't know, but he was certainly speaking a deep truth, because in fact, that's all we ever can enjoy. But we don't know that. We see the reflections of that energy, and so we think that, oh, those are what's giving us happiness. We see reflections of energy that we give to things in our expectation that this half gallon of ice cream is going to make me happy, and then we get it, oh boy, and we get all excited about this ice cream. But the truth is that it's we who give the energy to it. Otherwise, if ice cream made people happy, we'd all get happy in eating ice cream. I was watching TV the other day. That may sound strange to you because probably all of you own TV, but I don't. We don't have TV at Ananda. We're in the one percentile of this country, I guess, that don't. But I was in New York and we had a TV set in the apartment that John Novak and I were staying in. And so I learned many great lessons. I learned that Pampers are far better than ordinary cotton diapers because they absorb better. And I learned that Ivory Snow is it washes much better than other kinds of soap. And many other important lessons I learned. But what really surprised me, I was sort of trying to figure this one out. Okay, so these are facts, they're very good to know. But the glee with which I was informed of these things, the joy with which people announced that they had discovered Ivory Snow, it's really funny when you think of the enthusiasm that people can bring to bear on things. But the fact is that those things don't give them happiness. What is, they're generating this thing in their own minds and putting it out upon those things, and those things seem to reflect back to them a kind of energy, but they don't do it for everybody. I see people coming alive because they're in the Pepsi generation, and I think, well, this is a delusion. I'm sure there are just as many people who have drunk Pepsi Cola in solitary gloom. The truth is that no thing in this universe is going to give you anything that you don't first give to it. One time years ago, I got a ride in Los Angeles from the top of Mount Washington, where I was living, down the hill with a neighbor, and the sun was shining, as it usually does when it can get through the smog in Southern California, and I said something about how beautiful the day was. In fact, I felt very good. It was a lovely day. But this neighbor said, oh, this damn sun, I've been seeing nothing but sun in California for 20 years and I'm sick of it. I thought, here it was the same day and it was making him miserable and me happy. The truth is that we make ourselves miserable or we make ourselves happy by the energy that we put out. But we put things out to things and we see that reflection back and we think that it's the things that are giving us that. And so we get farther and farther away from that source behind us, or, not to speak in linear terms, the source is within, radiating outward in all directions. But the farther we get away from that core, that center of our being, the farther we get away from this power of peace, of calmness, of love, of joy, of wisdom, of understanding, of all the things that we know in our hearts. Not anyone in this world can fail to understand that that's what he really wants. But we get farther away from that into a consciousness that is away from love, becomes full of hatred. Away from peace, becomes full of nervousness. Away from joy, becomes full of suffering. And the saddest thing of all is that as we begin to center ourselves in that pain, in that suffering, in that hatred, in that nervousness, in that insecurity, in that doubt, that too becomes a new center. Remember, I said center everywhere, circumference nowhere. And so giving energy to that, making our center there, we generate a new kind of magnetism, a new center for our being. It's not our center, but it's a center we've created on the periphery of our consciousness. And that kind of energy that we put out from a center of nervousness generates things that will create more nervousness. If we have a center of joy, we generate a kind of energy that creates joy. We generate an energy from a center of nervousness, and we bring to ourselves more and more things that will cause us to be nervous. We generate an energy of hatred, and we bring to ourselves more and more things that create hatred, not just by accident. We actually draw to ourselves people who will hate us, people who will make us realize that we are justified in that hatred, because in our present state of consciousness, we will be justified in that hatred. That's the kind of reality we are creating, and that's the kind of reality we are bringing to a focus in ourselves. A monk who lived at Mount Washington, where I was living in this monastery, left the monastery after some years, and one of the reasons he left was that he couldn't stand one of the other monks there, a man called Jerry. You think, well, that shouldn't be so in monasteries, but people are people, after all. It's a delusion to think that as soon as you enter a monastery that suddenly you're a saint. Monasteries are created so that people can become saints, maybe. One or two here and there. In fact, Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, when she was the novice mistress in the monastery that she lived in France, she was approached by some of the young novices saying, why is it that in this place of God there should be a few older nuns who are so unspiritual, so full of anger and pettiness and so on? Some of these older nuns would wash clothes deliberately in such a way as to splash soap into the eyes of others and so on. They had lost their vocation, didn't have the courage to leave, and so they were just venting their frustration there. And they said, why? We've come to this house of God. Why here, of all places, should this sort of thing exist? Teresa's answer was marvelous. She said that if we didn't have such people, it would behoove us to go out and find them and bring them here. We need people like that. They help us to grow. But anyway, this boy left Mount Washington because there was one person like that. He came back a year later and said to me ruefully, you know how I couldn't stand Jerry? Where I'm working now, there are 6 men exactly like him. He was putting out that kind of energy, and so he drew it to him. And when he rejected that test, then he got all the more. It isn't so much that the test becomes greater, you become smaller. And so the test seems greater. Well, maybe in fact they weren't as bad as Jerry, but they seemed as bad, you see. So there were 6 of them. Well, when we generate a disharmonious energy, we create that, and we become justified in that thought. We feel justified in it, because in fact the kind of world we draw to ourselves, we don't draw good people. When we are bad, we draw bad people. And that makes us realize with absolute conviction that this world is no damn good, and everybody's out to get what he can for himself, and nobody's interested in helping anybody else. It's because they're not helping anybody else, because they're no damn good. Because they're living on this periphery and generating with that center a new kind of energy. That will go on and on. Because first of all, you see, let me try to explain this thing a little bit more. You get from your own periphery, your own center out to a periphery here. You generate you create a center there, a vortex that draws that kind of world around you. We are living in an age today that is very far down the road toward this delusion that I'm talking about now. It's a normal human condition anyway, but we've increased that condition by losing any sense of centeredness. We don't have traditions anymore. The family doesn't mean what it used to mean. We're in a state of transition. I think in the long run it's a good thing. I think we're going to come into an era where we will see things in a much more expanded way. But right now it's very uncomfortable. We have gotten so far off base, so far away from our own center, that we have created a world of intense nervousness, intense insecurity, intense fear, intense everything. All you have to do, if you want to look at it with eyes somewhat at a distance, sort of so that you can see it in proportion, All you have to do is listen to the kind of music that's being written. I'm not talking only of rock and roll and disco and that kind of thing, which is very obviously a kind of a shattering energy, but even classical music, so-called. Go to the symphony orchestra. I went to a concert a few months ago, and after listening to a symphony, I was thinking, well, you know, music is basically composed of three things, three elements: melody, harmony, rhythm. Am I not safe in making a statement like that? What are you going to do with music that doesn't have any three of those? Any one of those three? So much of modern music is totally jagged and disoriented. Look at art. Modern art. I have nothing against abstract art. Any form can produce greatness. But what you're seeing is not just the form, you're seeing a consciousness that's jagged behind that form. You're seeing something that has no sense of direction, no sense of purpose. It's all split up in pieces. This is what our psyche is today. We have gotten so far away from our center where we can listen with absolute approval to people when they write books like that famous one that was public seller number one on the bookseller lists last year, looking after number one. Containing such lofty philosophy as never do nothing for nobody unless there's something in it for you. And people nod their heads, yep, that's right. They've gotten so far away from any kind of grip on truth that if you come up and say that it's a good thing to be kind to people sometimes, they'll sort of pull their ears and say, deep, you know. Hadn't thought of that one. We just have lost sense of reality. We've lost touch with what it means to be good. We find that it's a philosophy proclaimed in books and movies and so on. Go to the average movie today, and if you can figure out what's going on, which if you can, I hand it to you. I can't half the time. But if you can, you realize that the message is one of absolute cynicism. Nobody's any good. Nobody's right. There, even the childish idea of good guys wear white hats and bad guys wear black hats, that's no longer true. The good guys are probably... there aren't good guys. The guys who are wearing the white hats are probably even worse than the guys who are wearing black hats. You get a sense that there's no goodness anywhere. You get a sense that there's no truth anywhere. You get a sense that anybody who wants to be honorable is being a sucker. You find people approving when people commit crimes and get away with them. We are living in an age that has gotten so far away from this center in ourselves that it's no longer on the periphery of our consciousness. It's sort of getting further and further away. Now, there are many ways to look at the human condition today. We can examine it from the standpoint of politics, economics, art, heaven knows what. But I think ultimately, we are the creator of whatever goes wrong with this world. As far as our world is concerned, I notice the ants when they walk there, they don't pay any attention to me. They've got another world going there. But our world is very real to us. And when we get away from these laws of our nature, then we generate a kind of magnetism that will bring back to us a suffering in kind. To give you an example, here we are in a culture today where people are living so much on credit that our country is more, the national debt of this country is greater than the sum total of national indebtedness of all other countries in the world. That's kind of scary. But the private indebtedness in this country is four times the public debt, four times the national debt. We are living so far outside ourselves, thinking, oh, it's no problem at all, just charge it, we only owe it to ourselves. In fact, we are cheating our unborn generations of children and grandchildren of their just dues. We're ripping this planet off of all its riches just so that we can have a Pepsi Cola and Pampers and Ivory Snow and all these wonderful things and get so excited about it. But you can't get away from reality. These realities of our own nature are being offended against in gross measure. And the truth is that there's got to come a day of reckoning. I could come at this subject from many different standpoints. Government saying that business is doing a terrible thing in raising its prices all the time, and that business is responsible for inflation. But here this week we find that in 1 week they have printed $4 billion new dollars, circulating them around. What happens when you get more and more dollars floating around? They become worth less and less, isn't it so? Any commodity that you get more and more of becomes cheaper. The dollar bills are because they're so plentiful, that's why we have them worth less and less, and that's what inflation is all about. We can see it from standpoints like that, and we can see what a mess we're making of things that way. But the truth of it is that it's not just this cause. We can blame it on the government. We can blame the nuclear reactors on people who have been greedy or who haven't investigated carefully, or all kinds of reasons. But the truth of it is that we are the cause. Our own consciousness puts those senators in power and encourages them to do more and more for us, to the point where they don't dare tax us to the extent that they would need to pay for all the things we want them to give us. The only way out of it that they can see, if they want to stay in power, is to feed us what we want by printing more dollars. We are, in fact, responsible for what we are bringing to ourselves, and we are due for a very great correction. I feel that we have come to a point now in our history where we are likely to find runaway inflation, where we are likely to find enormous social unrest, even revolution, where we are going to look back on this day here and say that it was a wonderful age compared to what we have now, because there will be many, many millions of people out of work. There will be great, great suffering in the world. We have brought it on ourselves by forgetting that we are really, our reality is here. It isn't out there. You can't go against the law. You can't go against the law of your own body. You can't go against the law of your own nature. And what is this whole population of people but individuals, all of them, who have a law of psychology, a law of spiritual reality in their own natures? If we go against that law, if we become too greedy, if we think that we can get a free lunch, if we think we can get everything for nothing, sooner or later we're going to have to wake up and find that it just isn't so. We cannot really create security if we're living out there. That's what caused our problem in the first place. A man after the First World War decided that the world was going to go into a tailspin, and there would certainly be another world war, and he didn't want to be around when it happened. So he examined all over the world. He looked all over the world for what he thought would be the safest spot. In about 1936 or 37, he finally settled on a place, and he bought property on the island of Guam. You can't do it if you do it only outwardly. That was the center of World War II in the Pacific. You can't find an outward security. Your real power, and this is what I want to get across tonight, if I possibly can, that the real power that's going on in this world is a spiritual power. Everything was created by that spiritual reality. Everything was created by God. You are a manifestation of spiritual realities first, and all these mental and physical things are only projections outward from that central spiritual fact. Until you bring that fact into play, until you learn to become centered in your inner self, everything outward will sooner or later cause disharmony, unhappiness, unrest, and then draw to itself from that center all the fruits of that kind of living, which will bring you suffering, pain, hatred, infidelity from others, loss of all that you dreamed of, failure, frustration. All these things come from basically one source. Now, does that seem simplistic? All I ask you to do is examine the lives of great saints, and you will find that always, being centered in themselves, things always worked out the way they should work out. People talk of the suffering of saints. Saints are not unhappy people. As Saint Teresa put it, a sad nun is a bad nun. And Saint Francis de Sales said, a sad saint is a sad saint indeed. Joy, is the hallmark of people who live in this state of consciousness, of attunement with God. Love is the hallmark of that. And whatever happens outside somehow is always, always works out for the best. Things just flow. Things work in wonderful ways for those who are in tune with the God within themselves. Nothing can shatter that peace of mind because they know where peace really comes from, not from that little cottage by the sea, which could go up in smoke if you just drop a cigarette in the wrong place. It comes from being in tune in your own inner self. Moreover, whatever the world does and whatever happens in the world outside yourself, if you've got that strength within yourself, if you can get centered here and radiate outward sufficient energy, because the center of yourself is where the greatest power is, that power diminishes as you get outside. But if you can become centered here, that power is very strong. That kind of magnetic force and that kind of radiation outward from that center will protect you, as the Bhagavad Gita says, even a little bit of the practice of this truth will free you, will spare you colossal fears and dire sufferings. It's true that that kind of magnetic energy that you radiate outward means it becomes like a sort of buffer zone, that aura, if you will, a buffer zone through which negative things simply won't even be able to penetrate, even if you've already, by past karma, generated that kind of energy that draws those results to your life. An example in our community was a young woman working there a year and a half ago, fell 10 feet on a construction site onto an 18-inch rusty nail, and it went through her thigh, right on the inside at the top of the thigh, where it could very easily have gone up into the abdominal cavity and killed her or created very severe troubles. She felt, because she was on the path, this aura of protection around her. And all the way to the hospital, she said, she felt this protection. When the doctor examined her, he couldn't believe his eyes. She had fallen in such a way as to tear a gash 6 inches long one way and then fallen the other way and torn a gash 4 inches long the other way. And the doctor found, he said, that no surgeon could have created a cleaner incision. He said it missed bone, artery, nerves, internal organs, everything. He said a cut of this type is very often fatal because you can't amputate and you can't clean it. It's so deep, and gangrene often sets in. But she was up in a week or two, bounding about as if nothing had ever happened. This is something, a circumstance that we have seen repeated in our community, and I have seen over many years I've known in these 30 years that I've been on this path many, many thousands of people personally. And I have yet to see somebody who's strongly in this path, strongly in himself. I'm not talking in a sectarian way. I'm talking of the path, not in practicing yoga, joining my church, all those kinds of things. I'm saying that when you get strong in yourself spiritually, when you can learn to be centered in your own soul, when you can learn to make that the center and radiate outward from that, I have yet to see somebody who's strongly centered there who has had anything really serious happen to him. We all die in time. But even death, when it comes, is joyful. It reminds me of a sister disciple when she was dying, and her last words were, "Too much joy, too much joy." This understanding that you've got everything that you want right here brings to you from that kind of magnetic power everything that you need. Everything happens for the best when you have that. Some people might say, well, if I do that, I feel selfish. If other people are suffering and I'm getting joy for myself, as Jean-Paul Sartre said, in this world that bleeds, all joy is obscene. My answer to that is that, is it really compassion when a person is drowning to jump into the water and drown with him? That's stupidity. That's not compassion. If you really want to help the person, be sure that you aren't drowning yourself. Get in a strong position, either as a strong swimmer or on dry land, and then you can reach out and help him. So if you are strong in yourself, that's not being selfish. That's doing the only thing that you can possibly do to help other people. Until you are strong in yourself, you won't have strength to give other people. Until you have joy in yourself, you won't have joy to give to other people. First, your one and only real duty in this world is to become centered in yourself. To get your trip together, to use the modern jargon, that you get centered in yourself. because only from that point will you be able to help other people. When you've got a bank account, then you can help other people. When you've got strength inside yourself, you can give strength to others. So don't feel that it's selfish to become happy in yourself. With that happiness, you will be able to lift others out of their sorrow. Not only that, but divine joy, as opposed to the smugness of material satisfaction, by its own nature longs to serve other people, longs to help others. It's impossible to have this joy and not want to lift other people up, because the nature of that joy is expansive, includes other people in its own consciousness. Now, I believe that it's very high time for us to take these thoughts seriously, not only because it's always high time, but because the world has conspired to bring us to the point where if we don't do it, we're going to be spun out of our orbit so fast we'll lose all sense of direction. We just won't know what to do anymore. We'll go around like crazy people. Where's that meal? Where's this? What can I do? How can I get any kind of security? There's going to come a kind of an insanity in the lives of people who are so far off center that they just don't even know that that center exists anymore. And suddenly what they thought they had created as a secure center has disintegrated under them. It's really high time that you took it seriously. It's high time, as I say, always, because the time for seeking God is always now. He is the Lord of here and now. There is no other reality except now. But it's even more so, in time, that this is a time to take seriously this understanding that we've got to learn to live superconsciously in ourselves. We've got to learn how to center ourselves in ourselves. We've got to learn how to become so strong inwardly that nothing outside can touch us. As Yogananda said, to reach that point where you can remain unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds, because this world as we know it now is breaking up. I'm bullish on America, really. I think that we're a great country, but we've got a corrective process to go through so that we can reclaim our greatness on true ground, not false ground. I think that we're going through a purging process rather than a destruction. But during that purging process, many, many lives will be shattered. I don't want your lives to be shattered. Let us then really take seriously that there is a dimension that we need to introduce into our lives today. Meditation. Understanding that we're not just a physical and a mental being, but, as I was saying before, a spiritual being. Learn how to attune yourself to that consciousness. Learn how to live superconsciously. Try to take this into your life, this message. Maybe you're living it already. It never hurts to find these truths reinforced. But from now on, let us all, I too, because we all need to sort of wake up every day and say, from now on, I'm going to do better than ever. Let us affirm tonight that from now on, we're going to be more and more in tune with that higher self within our own selves, more in tune than ever before. Thank you very much.